Hello, this is Mark Grier, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 2nd issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, first article for today. Fed's independence remains at risk despite temporary legal victory. A Supreme Court order keeping Lisa Cook on the Federal Reserve Board is a time to exhale but not breathe easy, one expert said. Lisa Cook notched a temporary win in her legal battle against President Trump this week when the Supreme Court said she could remain a governor on the Federal Reserve Board. But the threat to the Fed's longstanding independence will continue to loom large over the central bank for at least the next several months. The Supreme Court on Wednesday allowed Ms. Cook to remain in her job while her lawsuit against Mr. Trump proceeds. The president, who has tried to gain more control over the Fed, tried to fire her over unproven allegations of mortgage fraud. Still, the decision, part of a two-sentence unsigned order, fell short of a decisive victory for the central bank. Instead, the court agreed to wait to rule on Ms. Cook's status until after it hears arguments on the matter in January. It's time to exhale but not breathe easy, said Peter Conti Brown, an expert on Fed governance at the University of Pennsylvania. The wrecking ball that the Trump administration has been wielding through the administrative state just hit a brick wall that it could not crumble. Mr. Conti Brown warned, however, that the issue was far from resolved. Mr. Trump has accused Ms. Cook of committing mortgage fraud, citing that as justification to fire her. Under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, the president can remove a Fed only for official only for cause, which has typically meant gross malfeasance or a neglect of duty while serving in the job. Congress put that safeguard in place to ensure that the Fed was protected from undue meddling by the president. Ms. Cook, who has not been charged with a crime, has argued that the Trump administration's allegations are flimsy and unproven. She has also said Mr. Trump did not give her ample time to rebuke them before he fired her. It is not the first time Mr. Trump has taken aim at the country's independent agencies, but the order on Wednesday reaffirmed that the Supreme Court views the Fed as a distinct one. Earlier this year, the court granted the president the ability to remove leaders of independent institutions like the Federal Trade Commission and the National Labor Relations Board while the cases are being litigated. Mr. Trump fired Democratic officials from those two agencies purely because of policy differences, something previous court rulings barred. Jeremy Kress, a law professor at the University of Michigan, who previously worked as a lawyer at the Fed, said the court's move gave him more confidence that the justices would eventually side with Ms. Cook. Still, he cautioned against reading too much into what he described as an unexplained procedural order. Without a substantive rationale for why the Fed should be treated differently from the FTC or the NLRB, today's decision may simply be a temporary reprieve while the court considers how much control to give the president over the administrative state, he said. Until the court rules on the merits, Fed independence remains very much in jeopardy. How the court ends up ruling will have sweeping ramifications for the central bank, whose independence has formed the backbone of the world's largest economy and most important financial system. If the court sides with Ms. Cook, the threat to the Fed's independence will be significantly lessened, but not eradicated. One concern was that in ousting Ms. Cook, Mr. Trump would have an immediate vacancy to fill on the board with another loyalist. Already, he has been able to fill a spot that opened up unexpectedly in August after Adriana Kugler stepped down several months before her term expired. His pick to replace her, Stephen Marin, who is taking only a temporary leave of absence from the White House, has already made an impact in his short tenure at the Fed. He dissented when the central bank voted last month to lower interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point, instead favoring a half-point move. He has also spoken out repeatedly about the need for substantially lower borrowing costs. Mr. Trump has openly vied to have a majority of supporters on the seven-person board, which would give him greater influence over interest rates, policies related to Wall Street, and the inner workings of the Fed. The board must vote every 5 years on the reappointment of all 12 regional Fed bank presidents. The next deadline is at the end of February, adding yet more urgency to the president's desire to gain control of the board by then. Mr. Trump will also get to select a replacement for Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, whose term expires in May. The president gets to appoint governors and the Fed chair with the advice and consent of the Senate. So over the long term, he can still shape the central bank as vacancies come up, said Maurice Obstfeld, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, who was formerly the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. But if the Supreme Court sides with Mr. Trump after hearing the case in January, the president and his successors will have a more open path to remove Fed officials. Last week, every living former chair of the Fed joined other leading economists in a friend of the court brief that suggested that enabling Mr. Trump to remove Ms. Cook would expose the Federal Reserve to political influence, thereby eroding public confidence in the Fed's independence and jeopardizing the credibility and efficiency of U.S. monetary policy. Keeping Ms. Cook in place while the underlying legal questions are in flux would serve the public's interest by safeguarding the independence and stability of the system that governs monetary policy in this country, they wrote, an argument that her lawyers have also promoted. For the United States democracy, it's the right call, Kenneth Rogoff, a Harvard economist who signed the brief, said of the court's decision on Wednesday. You need an independent Fed with a strong anti-inflation bias in order to preserve economic and market stability. All right, next article. Trump administration asks colleges to sign compact to get funding preference. Demands sent to nine top schools included pledging to freeze tuition for 5 years and to commit to strict definitions of gender. The White House on Wednesday sent letters to nine of the nation's top public and private universities, urging campus leaders to pledge support for President Trump's political agenda to help ensure access to federal research funds. The letters came attached to a 10-page compact that serves as a sort of priority statement for the administration's educational goals. The most comprehensive accounting to date of what Mr. Trump aims to achieve from an unparalleled months-long pressure campaign and academia. The compact would require colleges to freeze tuition for 5 years, cap the enrollment of international students, and commit to strict definitions of gender. Among other steps, universities would also be required to change their governance structures to prohibit anything that would punish, belittle, or even spark violence against conservative ideas. Colleges that sign the agreement would receive multiple positive benefits, according to a letter included with the compact signed by Education Secretary Linda McMahon. Vince Haley, the director of the White House Domestic Policy Council, and May Mailman, the White House's senior advisor for special projects. Colleges that agree would get priority access to federal funds and looser restraints on overhead costs. Signed compacts would also serve as assurance to the government that schools are complying with civil rights laws. Federal civil rights investigations have been used to halt much of the research funding that the administration has blocked so far this year. Letters on Wednesday were sent to the University of Arizona, Brown University, Dartmouth College, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Southern California, the University of Texas, Vanderbilt University, and the University of Virginia. The nine schools declined to comment or did not immediately respond to messages late on Wednesday. Ms. Mailman, who has orchestrated much of the administration's higher education strategy, said the compact could ultimately be extended to all colleges and universities. She said the administration was open to hearing feedback about the compact from college leaders. "We hope all universities ultimately are able to have a conversation with us," she said. The letters were sent as the White House was aiming to close a settlement with Harvard University, the only university to sue the administration over its pressure campaign. Mr. Trump on Tuesday said that a deal, which has been elusive as talks stalled, was close to being finalized. The Wall Street Journal first reported that the compact has been sent to schools. The administration has secured individual deals with schools to restore funding, requiring the universities to pay steep fines and effectively adopt new policies. And while there is some overlap in the agreements, the first round of deals has all stood on their own. The University of Pennsylvania agreed to align its athletic policies with the Trump administration's beliefs about participation by transgender people. Brown University promised to provide a more granular level of student admissions data than is required by law. The so-called Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education is effectively a declaration of the administration's political priorities for higher education. The first round of schools received the compact along with a letter that frames the pledge as an opportunity to proactively partner with the administration and its effort to shift the ideological tilt of the higher education system, which the president and his team view as hostile to conservatives and intent on perpetuating liberalism. The demands in the compact also include providing free tuition to students studying math, biology, and other hard sciences if endowments exceed $2 million per undergraduate. Institutions of higher education are free to develop models and values other than those below if the institution elects to forego federal benefits, the compact says. All right, on to another article. Drones, helicopters, hundreds of arrests. Trump's immigration crackdown in Chicago so far. The administration announced a federal operation in the Chicago area more than 3 weeks ago. Agents have appeared along downtown streets, and the National Guard troops are expected. The Trump administration has vowed for more than a month to bring a show a federal force to Chicago, the nation's third largest city, to crack down on illegal immigration. This week, the administration has visibly followed through. On Sunday, federal officers in camouflage patrolled tourist-heavy areas in downtown Chicago in a conspicuous pack, attracting stares and taunts, including from a bicyclist the agents tried to chase. On Monday, U.S. military officials said that 100 National Guard troops would be deployed to Illinois to protect federal facilities, a mobilization that is expected in the coming days. And early on Tuesday, federal agents using drones, helicopters, trucks, and dozens of vehicles, conducted a middle-of-the-night raid of a rundown apartment building on the south side of Chicago, leaving the building mostly empty of residents by morning and neighbors stunned. "It felt like we were under siege," said one bystander, Daryl Ballard, 63, showing videos on his cell phone of officers entering the apartment building in the dark. A U.S. Border Patrol official involved with the operation, who spoke on the condition of remaining anonymous because he was not authorized to discuss the matter publicly, said that the effort involved nearly 300 federal agents from various agencies. The agents came from various directions around the building. The operation that night targeted an apartment complex that federal officials said was frequented by members of the Tren de Aragua gang. The Border Patrol officials said that snipers rappelled down from helicopters on top of the apartment complex as a precaution from potential violence. Federal authorities said that at least 37 people without legal immigration status were arrested, including some with criminal records. Since early September, when the Trump administration announced the immigration crackdown in the Chicago area, calling it Operation Midway Blitz, agents have arrested more than 800 people, the Department of Homeland Security said. The Trump administration will not allow violent criminals or repeat offenders to terrorize our neighborhoods or victimize our children and innocent Americans, said Tricia McLaughlin, Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs for the department. But activists and lawyers for some of those arrested in recent weeks said that the administration has rounded up people, including some U.S. citizens, with no history of violence in its sweeps. DHS officials acknowledged that 4 children who are U.S. citizens were taken into custody amid the operation at the apartment complex on Tuesday until they could be placed in the care of guardians. Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois and Mayor Brandon Johnson of Chicago have condemned the push from President Trump, saying that the Trump administration was militarizing the city without making residents safer. Mr. Pritzker, a Democrat, said the effort was calculated to damage and intimidate Chicago, calling the federal officers jackbooted thugs roaming around a peaceful downtown. He added that parents were afraid to send children to school and that small businesses were suffering. "Get out of Chicago," he said this week. "You are not helping us." Democrats in Illinois have also spoken out against Mr. Trump's plan, which he revealed on Tuesday while speaking to a room full of military leaders, to use Chicago and other American cities as training grounds for future wars. "We're going to straighten them out one by one, and this is going to be a major part for some of the people in this room," Mr. Trump said. Mr. Johnson said in a statement on Wednesday that he rejects any attempt to militarize American cities. "Chicagoans are not test subjects for the president to train our military," he said. "The brave men and women who sign up to serve our country do not want to be deployed against their neighbors." The Trump administration's crackdown had some defenders, including Darren Bailey, a Republican former state senator who is running for governor. "It is a shame that the federal government has to send the military into Chicago just to protect ICE officers," he said, referring to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. "This is what failed leadership looks like." Raymond Lopez, the city council members, cheered the immigration operation on Tuesday, saying on social media that the people who were arrested will not be missed. It is not yet clear where National Guard troops will be sent, but one potential location could be an immigrant processing center in Broadview, Illinois, a small suburb west of Chicago. Clashes have broken out at the facility between protesters and ICE officers in recent weeks, as protesters have tried to block government vehicles from entering or leaving the facility, and officers have responded forcefully with tear gas and other chemical agents. Some residents said they were rattled by the sight of groups of federal agents making arrests downtown and questioned the motives of Mr. Trump, who has criticized Chicago and its Democratic leadership for years. Concerns about crime run deep in Chicago, which has higher rates of gun violence than other major cities its size, but lower rates than smaller cities such as Memphis or Detroit. In the last several years, crime has decreased sharply in Chicago, with double-digit drops in shootings, robberies, burglaries, and car thefts. Murders have dropped nearly 50% in the last 4 years, police statistics show. National Guard troops are expected to be focused on protecting federal immigration facilities, not working with the police on crime-fighting efforts. On Tuesday evening, hundreds of demonstrators amassed in downtown Chicago to protest the increase in activity by ICE, marching up one of the most recognizable streets in the city, Michigan Avenue. Chuck Mackey, a 68-year-old marketing writer from the north side of Chicago, said he felt as if there has been a gradual buildup of ICE activity to deliberately condition the public. It's a continued breakdown of norms and constitutional protections, he said, calling Mr. Trump's request of 100 National Guard troops unnecessary. Mona Obregon-Ketch, 70, a retired hospital administrator from Berwyn, Illinois, said she worried that Mr. Trump was trying to normalize a military presence in American cities. People need to study and see how things in the past happened in other countries, she said. The operation has faced opposition since it began. The National Immigrant Justice Center and the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois filed a legal challenge last week against the arrests of 35 people, including three U.S. citizens, that they argue had violated a prior consent decree limiting ICE from conducting warrantless arrests and traffic stops. In one pre-dawn operation, which Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, personally oversaw and later posted to her social media account, a helicopter and tens of federal officers wearing military-style technical gear and high-powered rifles and flash-bang grenades descended on a home in Elgin, Illinois. Inside, a man was getting ready for work when he saw red lasers all over the kitchen and the front door, and suddenly heard an explosion, according to the filing contesting the 35 arrests. The government has not responded to the filing yet. Ms. McLaughlin has said the agency does not arrest or deport citizens and described its operation as highly targeted. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. All right, next article. White House seeks a blunt Democrats' shutdown strategy on health care. President Trump has made lowering health care costs a key priority, even as Democrats warn that costs will skyrocket. On the first day of the government shutdown, the White House on Wednesday insisted that President Trump wanted to fix the health care system, the very issue that Democrats in Congress have said is their top priority. White House officials, including Vice President J.D. Vance, said that Mr. Trump was open to Democratic leaders' suggestions for improving access to health insurance, but they were adamant that the shutdown was not needed to meet that goal. "We need to reopen the United States federal government because people are going without pay," said Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary. "Then we can discuss this very important issue of health care that the president absolutely wants to fix." Democrats on Wednesday were also keenly focused on health care, saying they had voted against the Republicans' budget bill because they were seeking to keep health care costs from ballooning for millions of Americans, including in states that Mr. Trump won last year. The tug of war over which side cares more about health care speaks to the issue's political potency. Mr. Trump has made lowering health costs a key part of his agenda, and Democrats appear to see an opening to rein in the White House and preserve a set of subsidies that help millions of Americans pay for coverage. Republicans have tried to drive their message by repeating the false assertion that Democrats were shutting down the government to fund free health care for unauthorized immigrants. Hours before the shutdown on Tuesday, Mr. Trump held two Oval Office events promoting health policy actions. One announcing a deal the administration made with the drug maker Pfizer for the company to lower prices and charges to state Medicaid programs, and another on accelerating research into children with cancer. If Democrats actually cared about health care, they would applaud the actions taken by President Trump, Ms. Leavitt said on Wednesday. Democrats are holding out on voting for the spending bill, hoping to extend Obamacare subsidies that are set to expire at the end of the year, and to reverse cuts to Medicaid and other health programs that were part of legislation Mr. Trump signed into law in July. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic minority leader, said he believed that his party had a winning message. "We are going to be fighting everywhere, on TV stations like yours, in the social media, in picketing, in protesting, in emails, in every way," he said on Wednesday on Morning Joe, the MSNBC show. "And when the average American says, 'Why the heck did I get a bill that raises my health care cost, doubles them?' we're going to be pointing out it's the Republicans who did it." The shutdown comes as both parties attempt to explain why scores of government jobs could be cut and why critical services could come to a halt. The White House has launched an aggressive effort to blame Democrats for the shutdown, even using government websites to disparage the party. Officials have also attempted to use another key issue for Mr. Trump's base, immigration, to bolster their claims that Democrats were prioritizing undocumented immigrants over American citizens. On Wednesday, it sent out a powerful surrogate to carry its message to the public. Speaking to reporters from the White House briefing room, Mr. Vance complained that Democrats had positioned themselves as champions of health care, but had not supported Mr. Trump's efforts. Democrats say that they care a lot about lowering health care costs, and yet, when the president took historic action to work with the drug companies to lower prescription prices, the Democrats did nothing to help us, Mr. Vance said. He added, "What they have done instead is to shut down the government because we won't give billions of dollars to health care funding for illegal aliens." Mr. Vance said the Democratic leaders had proposed ideas for improving health care access that Mr. Trump would consider, but that it was wrong to force a shutdown until the president agreed to them. On Wednesday, Mr. Trump did not appear publicly and did not directly address the shutdown, except to attack Representative Maxine Waters of California, a frequent Democratic target of his on social media. The White House used a press briefing room to play clips of Democrats criticizing previous shutdowns. As the day came to a close, the screens played on a loop an AI-generated video that Mr. Trump posted on social media earlier this week, mocking Mr. Schumer and depicting Representative Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic minority leader, who is black, as a Mexican. Mr. Jeffries called the video racist, while Mr. Vance on Wednesday defended it as funny. Okay, next article. Enough is enough. Many Palestinians say Hamas must accept ceasefire plan. Interviews in Gaza suggest wide support for a proposal that calls for an immediate end to a war that has brought immense civilian suffering. Palestinians in Gaza have spent almost 2 years long for an end to the war that has destroyed their communities and killed tens of thousands of their neighbors. Many say their best hope yet is the latest ceasefire plan proposed by the United States, if only Hamas would accept it. Hamas must say yes to this offer. We have been through hell already, said Mohammed Bolbo, 43, a construction worker who has remained in Gaza City with his 6 children in the battered shell of their home throughout the war. President Trump unveiled the proposal while meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel at the White House on Monday. President Trump said that if Hamas did not accept its terms, then he would give Israel the green light to finish the job of destroying the armed group. Hamas has not yet given its response to the proposal, but interviews with Palestinians in Gaza on Wednesday suggested widespread public support for the plan. It calls for an immediate end to a war that has brought immense civilian suffering. For the past 2 days, Mr. Bolbo said his neighbors have talked about almost nothing but the ceasefire proposal. If Hamas rejects it, he said, his family would finally leave Gaza City and head for what he hoped would be the relatively safety of the enclave south. Hamas needs to understand, enough is enough, Mr. Bolbo said. Most Gazans are not members of the group, he added, so why drag us into this? The plan requires Hamas to release all of the remaining hostages it seized during the October 7, 2023 attack in southern Israel within 72 hours of the proposal going into effect. That includes an estimated 20 abductees believed to still be alive and the bodies of about 25 others. In exchange, Israel would release about 250 Palestinian prisoners serving life sentences in Israel. An additional 1,700 Gazans detained during the war, and the remains of 15 dead Gazan prisoners for each Israeli hostage whose body is returned. But the proposal contains several elements that Hamas has said are unacceptable. Those include a ban on the group exercising future power in Gaza, a requirement that it disarm, and the establishment of a traditional government overseen by foreign officials, including Mr. Trump and Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister. The proposal unveiled on Monday sent a rare flash of hope through Gaza, people said in interviews, but others are less hopeful. Some people said the terms of the proposal made them doubt that Hamas would agree. Others said their doubts grew from something more basic and bitter. They simply did not believe that Hamas would put the interests of the Palestinian people above the interests of their organization. We are dying for nothing, and no one cares about us, said Nasihim Mukwat, 30, who fled Israel's expanding military campaign in Gaza City for the territories south on Monday with her young daughter, Celine. Hamas needs to think more of us and what we have been through. Abdalam Awad, 57, who manages a bakery in Deir al-Abesh in central Gaza, said he would accept almost any price to end the war, but he said he did not believe that Hamas could say the same thing. They don't care about what people think or public opinion, he said. If they cared about that, we wouldn't be in this situation. In Khan Yunis, in southern Gaza, Mohammed Abu Matar, 35, said he hoped the United States could somehow force Hamas to accept the deal and then make both the armed group and Israel abide by all its terms. My wish is that Trump forces it as a reality on both sides, directly, without giving a choice, said Mr. Abu Matar, who once sold electrical appliances in Gaza City. He said that fighting had forced him to move around northern Gaza 10 times with his wife and three children until last week when they fled to the south for the first time. He said he was disgusted with the negotiators in faraway conference rooms who seemed to control his family's fate. The ones negotiating on my behalf are sitting in air-conditioned rooms, he said. They are not the ones living in sand, walking half an hour to fetch water, or searching for a bag of flour and getting killed. All right, next article is from the opinion section. What it takes for a working-class kid to get college education. Article by Beth Macy. Like many Americans, I left my small Ohio town for college and then followed professional opportunities to a larger city. My working-class parents hadn't gone to college, but I did, thanks to nurturing K-12 schools and to the federal government's Pell Grant program for poor kids, of whom I was certainly one. Over the years, I have worked as a journalist and author, dropping back into Urbana for holidays and reunions. But around 10 years ago, I began to go for longer stretches to look in on my aging mom. My hometown still had the same postcard cute facade, but I quickly realized something drastic was underway. For the first time, I noticed Confederate flags flying in a town once heralded as an underground railroad hub. I didn't recognize the place in which I had once known people on nearly every block of every street. I wanted to retain that recognition, not just for myself, but also because I want to live in a country where believing different things doesn't mean complete estrangement. This desire led me to meet Silas James, a high school senior and marching band drum major, whom the teachers at Urbana High described as a young Beth Macy, by which that meant a relatively smart and hardworking kid whose family situation was insecure, verging on chaotic, and who needed help. Silas's future seemed bright, except for at least one detail. He didn't have a car. But it's not just having a car that starts every time that people on the other side of poverty might take for granted. I'm not exaggerating when I say it was a miracle that I left Urbana for college in my mom's rusty Mustang, praying the whole way that its slipping clutch would not give out. I managed the good fortune to leave town before falling into premature parenthood or addiction, both of which have saddled generations of my family. My dad died of late-stage alcoholism and lung cancer when I was 19. As I got to know Silas, I was struck by how much steeper the climb out of poverty was for him. I grew up with examples of success all around me. I counted not just teachers and parents of my friends, but also a local judge, his librarian wife, and our mailman, whose route overlapped with my paper route, among my loudest cheerleaders. Not so for Silas. In Champaign County, of which Urbana is the seat, the number of food stamp recipients has nearly doubled since 1990, and foster care placements have tripled since 2015. It would not be an exaggeration to say that Silas is just one of many struggling people in Urbana. As Silas led the marching band onto the field, crowds cheering, he was homeless and couch surfing at friends' houses and dealing with an aftermath of having been sexually abused by an acquaintance while his parents were in jail. Silas's father, an intermittent presence in his life, who also struggled and would die of methadone overdose combined with COVID and a heart blockage. No one doubted Silas had the intellectual chops to attend a four-year university, but his steadiest mentor, his band director, urged him to enter a short-term trade program at a community college so he could avoid crushing student debt, a job as a certified welder, which Silas determined would be his future, paid more than twice as much as his McDonald's shifts. Pell grants covered my tuition, room and board, and even my books, because of skyrocketing college costs and the drastic defunding of higher education dating back to the 1980s. Today's Pell grant cover roughly 30% of a poor kid's four-year education. Silas got scholarships for his community college program, but they covered tuition. He had no funding for reliable transportation for his two-hour daily commute. No public transit was available either, nor could he pay for housing near the college that would have also moved him from his family's traumatic environment. Throughout the 2023 and 2024 school year, I watched as Silas went through five clunker cars and four low-wage jobs while attending community college. While I worked work-study jobs for beer and pizza money during college, Silas worked full-time for living expenses. Hardships in his family were a constant drag on his psyche. He dropped out the first week of his first semester after his mother got into a car wreck and required round-the-clock supervision for a concussion. During his second semester, his mother began using drugs again and lost custody of Silas's younger siblings. By the time Silas earned his welding certification, the best welder in his class, he was 19 and about to be named the legal guardian of two teenage siblings. His only debt was a small loan he took out to buy the most reliable car he could afford to get himself through the program's final months, a Honda Accord with 211,000 miles that was younger than Silas by a year. I could not have handled the responsibility of being a teenager raising teenagers, but Silas has largely thrived. He's engaged to be married to his boyfriend, whose teacher parents are supportive, and is employed in a managerial position with benefits in a nearby town. Silas's transition into adulthood has no doubt been complicated by his parents' choices, but the degree to which he has had to literally pay for those choices is stark. My own parents struggled, but thanks to robust schools and college grants that I have more than paid back through my taxes, I was able to turn the page on those struggles in a way that Silas perhaps will never be able to. While college completion rates have been trending upward for decades, a degree remains out of reach for a lot of Americans, many of whom have bought the story that they wouldn't want to go anyway. The flywheel of economic fatalism and resentment, fueled by wages that don't seem to budge, has been spinning now for two generations. That sense of hopelessness is a primary driver of partisan hatred and inequity. For the past 40 years, Republican and Democratic leadership alike stopped thinking of higher education as a public good and basically privatized it to the tune of more than $1.7 trillion in individual student debt. I'm no better than Silas, and it's not fair that he and his siblings continue to face such a fierce headwinds without the help I took for granted. We owe him more, we owe all our children more. Okay, next article. Mamdani says he would phase out New York City gifted program for early grades. Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic frontrunner in the mayor's race, plans, if elected, to replace the selective program, which became a symbol of segregation in public schools. Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic frontrunner for mayor of New York City, plans to end the gifted and talented program for kindergarten students in public schools if he is elected, calling for a major overhaul of a program that has deeply divided parents. Mr. Mamdani said in a statement that he would embrace former Mayor Bill de Blasio's plan, announced in 2021, to phase out the gifted program for elementary schools, which has been widely criticized for exacerbating segregation. Students who are in gifted classes would remain in the program, but there would be no gifted program for kindergartners next fall, his campaign said on Wednesday. Mr. Mamdani's plan would reshape education for some of the youngest children in the nation's largest school system and could reignite a fraught citywide debate over how and whether New York should address inequity in the enrollment of its selective academic programs. I will return to the previous policy, Mr. Mamdani said in the statement. Ultimately, my administration would aim to make sure that every child receives a high-quality early education that nurtures their curiosity and learning. Mr. Mamdani has proposed an ambitious plan to provide free childcare for every child under the age of 5, which he said would provide a groundbreaking opportunity to ensure all children can access the early care and education they need to succeed in future grades. His statement about the gifted program came in response to a questionnaire that the New York Times sent to the leading candidates in the race about major issues the city is facing. His two opponents, former Governor Andrew Cuomo and Curtis Sliwa, said they would keep the gifted program and expand it if elected mayor. Mr. Mamdani also said that he would keep a controversial admissions test at a group of 8 elite public high schools, backing away from his previous comments expressing concerns about the exam's fairness. New York is unusual among large U.S. school districts in enrolling kindergartners in a separate gifted and talented programs. It offers spots to fewer than 5% of children in kindergarten and has been criticized for admitting few Black and Latino students into the classes, which can serve as a pipeline to the city's most desired public middle schools. In 2021, under the de Blasio administration, the city abandoned an admissions test for 4-year-olds that had long been in use. Mr. de Blasio announced in his final months in office that the students who were enrolled in gifted classes at the time would be the last in the existing program. Mayor Eric Adams broke with Mr. de Blasio when he took office in 2022, choosing to keep the gifted program and to expand it. His administration switched to a process that relies on preschool teachers to nominate students for the program and has not prioritized school desegregation efforts. Students are also admitted into gifted classes through a separate third grade track, and Mr. Mondani's campaign declined to say whether he would end that option. Mr. de Blasio had proposed an alternative when he was in office, evaluating all rising third graders to determine whether they need higher level instruction in specific subject areas for 1 or 2 periods a day. The gifted program, which generally offers the same curriculum as general education classes, but with accelerated instruction, offers spots to only about 2,500 children out of roughly 55,000 total kindergartners. About 1,800 additional students are offered seats in third grade. But it has been a subject of heated debate for years. Supporters argue that the gifted and talented programs is a haven for bright students and that it keeps middle-class families in public schools who might otherwise leave the charter or private schools, leave for charter or private schools. Critics say it has worsened racial segregation, creating exclusive classrooms occupied mainly by white and Asian students. In the fall of 2022, Black and Latino children accounted for roughly two-thirds of the public school system's enrollment, but only a third of the kindergartners who were offered spots in gifted classes. Their enrollment was notably higher in the third grade tract. "It's a flashpoint," said David Bloomfield, a professor of education, leadership, law, and policy at Brooklyn College and the City University of New York Graduate Center. Professor Bloomfield said that New York had struggled to create an admission system for the gifted program that seems suitable for four-year-olds, an age at which experts say measuring a child's ability and potential can be thorny. He said that Mr. Mamdani's stance on the kindergarten classes seemed to represent the first step in an actual policy to promote desegregation. "In my opinion," he said, "it's a good move." Justin Brannan, a city council member from Brooklyn, who chairs the finance committee and is an ally of Mr. Mamdani, said the current teacher nomination system was flawed. "The teachers and parents I speak with agree we need to give kids some time to be kids, and then we can offer access to accelerated learning programs in the later years of elementary school," he said. In the mayor's race, schools have received less attention than other issues, such as public safety and affordability. Mr. Mamdani, 33, has not yet articulated a clear vision for schools. Instead, he has emphasized his plan to establish free universal child care for children from 6 weeks to 5 years old. Mr. Mamdani grew up in Manhattan and received a mix of public and private education. He attended the Bank Street School for Children, a progressive private school for students in kindergarten through eighth grade on the Upper West Side, and the Bronx High School of Science, a highly selective public high school. He has said that he wants to erase mayoral control of the school system and instead give teachers and parents a greater say. He said in the questionnaire that he wants to keep the specialized exam used to determine admissions to the elite schools and that he supports recommendations by a major school diversity panel in 2019 for changes to elementary and middle schools. The panel proposed eliminating all gifted programs in the city. "As a Bronx Science alum, I've seen both the promise and problems of specialized high school students," he said. The city's eight specialized high schools admit few Black and Latino students. This school year, Black students received 3% of acceptance letters and Latino students just under 7%, the city announced this summer. Mr. Mamdani has been considering whom he would hire as school counselor, or school chancellor, excuse me, according to two people familiar with the matter. The candidates who were floated this summer include Misha Ross Porter, who was briefly chancellor under Mayor de Blasio, Kamar Samuels, the superintendent of a school district in Manhattan, and Rita Joseph, a Brooklyn City Council member and the chair of the council's education committee. Mr. Cuomo, who is second in the polls, lost to Mr. Mamdani in June's Democratic primary and is running as an independent in the November election. He said in a statement that he would expand the gifted and talented programs with more seats in each borough. "Limiting opportunity to less than 5% of students is unfair," he said. "The real inequity is access. Too many Black and Latino students aren't identified or supported early enough." Mr. Sliwa, the Republican candidate, who was third in the polls, said he would expand the gifted program and that he was worried about poor test scores in English and math. "The focus should be on raising standards for everyone so more kids can qualify, not eliminating opportunities for a few who do, he said. Maya Wiley, a co-chairwoman of the diversity panel that recommends ending gifted programs and a candidate for mayor 4 years ago, said Mr. Mamdani had the right approach and that the existing system prioritized families with more resources. Every child deserves to be challenged in a classroom at every age, she said. We have to stop settling for what's broken. Okay, last article for today. Two planes collide on LaGuardia Airport taxiway. A plane that was prepared to take off struck a plane that had landed, the authorities said. One passenger was injured. Two regional flights operated by Endeavor Air, a subsidiary of Delta Airlines, collided in a LaGuardia Airport taxiway on Wednesday evening, injuring one passenger, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey said. The Bombardier CRJ-900 jet was preparing to take off when it struck another Bombardier that was heading to a gate at 9:58 p.m., according to a statement from the Port Authority, which manages LaGuardia in Queens. Video and photos posted on social media showed one of the planes missing a wing. Passengers were taken by bus to a terminal at the airport, and one person was hospitalized for non-life-threatening injuries, the Port Authority said. The cause of the accident was unclear. As of early Thursday, Delta Airlines did not immediately respond to an inquiry, and representatives for Endeavor could not immediately be reached for comment. Airlines often use the CRJ-900, a single-aisle plane that can carry as many as 90 passengers on shorter routes. The LaGuardia collision happened in the first 24 hours of a government shutdown that has disrupted federal services and sent many federal employees home without pay. Air traffic controllers are working through the shutdown because they are considered essential workers, and the spending impasse was not expected to have a major immediate effect on air travel. But the shutdown could become more disruptive to travelers the longer it persists, because about a quarter of the nearly 45,000 people who work at the Federal Aviation Administration are being furloughed during the shutdown. Some air services related to air traffic safety will be put on hold. And the FAA said in August that it expected to hire at least 8,900 air traffic controllers by 2028, an effort that would be stalled by the government shutdown. A critical shortage of air traffic controllers has contributed to aviation accidents and near misses at several U.S. airports in recent years. In May, flights at Newark Airport were delayed for up to 7 hours because there were not enough air traffic controllers scheduled to work. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your reader today has been Mark Greyer. Thank you for listening.